The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly in the first Champions League semi-final. Soft power 3, soft drinks 0. Credit Philippe Auclair. PSG blow RB Leipzig apart in a disappointingly one-sided affair as the German in the ankle boot defeats the German in the ambitious suit. How do you defend against Neymar and Mbappe? Not like that, clearly. Galacticos in front of sensible footballers on the pitch. Have PSG finally got it right? In the Europa League, Inter smash Shakhtar. At least none of us said Shakhtar had a chance. Ronald Koeman picks up Barca's poison chalice. Joe Hart is a Spur. Is there another Newcastle takeover? And Sociedad gazump Lazio. We'll do all that, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Philippe Auclair, bonjour, ça va?
Ça va bien, et toi?
Ça va bien. Archie Rintat, guten Morgen, wie geht's?
Guten Morgen, sehr gut, und bei dir?
Ganz gut, danke. Top of the morning to you, Barry Glendening.
Obigara Touroulou.
All right then, RB Leipzig nil. Paris Saint-Germain 3, PSG's first major European final since the Cup Winners' Cup in 1997, a year before Kylian Mbappe was born. Chris says, not a question, just a welfare check on Barry. I presume you were supporting... Well, were you supporting Leipzig in this one, Barry?
Well, yes, but it's a game in which both teams are objectionable for different reasons. And I suppose the only hope was that we'd get a game that was so good you'd be able to look past those reasons for finding both teams objectionable. But sadly, it was a pretty torpid affair, which PSG won at a stroll. So they're through to the final. I mean, it was a poor game. A couple of highlights, but I didn't particularly enjoy it.
Did you think it would be that easy for Paris Saint-Germain, Philippe?
Not quite, but I think perhaps I hadn't seen enough of RB Leipzig to have a proper opinion because I was expecting far, far better from that side. Maybe I underestimated, you know, the fact that obviously they haven't got Timo Werner any longer and they really missed him. I was also surprised by Nagelsmann's passivity because he's always been presented as a hands-on coach and the rest of it. Then his passivity actually contrasted with the fact that Tuchel had actually taken some big decisions before this game. Like we were expecting, for example, to have Mauro Icardi up front and to have the Fantastic Four, as they call them, together. He decided against that, decided against having Gay. Had a three-man proper midfield with a fantastic Marquinhos, which I would say was probably one of the highlights of the game. So, but yes, I was surprised and not in a particularly nice way about RB Leipzig. And I was expecting far more of a game than what we saw.
As the German representative, Archie, it sort of feels like it's your fault that this game was so bad.
Well, the worst thing is I went on the radio before this and talked up how active and attacking Julian Nagelsmann's side were. And then I saw the first half unfold in front of me and I was like, well, that's not particularly active. And yeah, it was probably one of, if not the worst performance that RB Leipzig have turned in this season, which Julian Nagelsmann was not, it was not like he came onto TV after and was raging about it. He explained what happened in a very cool manner, how he was happy with the way they started the game. But then after that, they were indeed too passive and they weren't able to implement the game plan. And I was surprised that he left it until half time to make substantial changes. That is not very Nagelsmann-like. If he sees a problem, he will usually fix it pretty quickly. But I think one of the most indicative things for me of why they lost was explained in the argument that Thomas Tuchel had with Julian Nagelsmann on the touchline in the second half. And Nagelsmann said that was about the way that Leipzig were fouling PSG so often that Thomas Tuchel was wanting to protect his players. And Nagelsmann was explaining, no, it wasn't a plan for us to foul you this much. You were just too quick.
They did foul them a lot, didn't they? But the PSG players, and I tweeted this, all seem to go down in exactly the same way in that they sort of jump back into the player and then collapse, you know. I mean, obviously Neymar is very good at this, but it almost looked like they'd had lessons, Barry. So they were all doing it in the same way.
Well, I don't know what to say to that, really. I wouldn't rule it out. It is possible they're coached in how to win fouls and that their moves are choreographed, nothing would surprise me.
You make it sound like one of those military maneuvers, you know, when you're like having those training days and you're crawling underneath those big nets.
Mm. I just think sort of falling lessons. It's a conspiracy that I want to push. Chrissy tweeted me in response to say, a friend of mine who works as a stuntman on Bond films at Pinewood has just spent the last couple of weeks working in Lisbon. Perhaps he's making a connection that I couldn't possibly make. The thing is, Archie, the goals that they conceded were all so avoidable, right? One is a set piece. It's a beautiful ball and it's a lovely header. And maybe sometimes that happens. But the other two, it's not like PSG, who do break amazingly quickly and did have chances to score when they broke quickly, scored goals that way. They scored goals that way because they were just two ridiculous pieces of defending.
Yeah, and that's what was being said after the game by Leipzig. They only have themselves to blame. And it's why the analysis of the game, Julian Nagelsmann was very relaxed before the game and very relaxed after it, as his attire suggested as well.
I would not be relaxed in those trousers. They were so tight. But anyway, we'll get on to that.
I'd call it a smart relaxed then, if that's a fair theme. But yeah, they only had themselves to blame. But also it's symbolic of the way they've been since the Corona restart, which is they've continually shot themselves in the foot and slipped away from a potential title challenge with a lot of needless draws. So, look, ultimately, I think there are boundaries for what this team can achieve, particularly when you take Timo Werner out of it. But also, this was the first time in the Champions League that they'd faced a side who could properly attack. Atletico Madrid looked to play against you more on the counter. Jose Mourinho's Tottenham are not exactly known for their free-flowing football. So this is the first time that they faced a PSG side who Julian Nagelsmann was very complimentary of how variable they were in the way they were opening up from the back and how they couldn't quite cope with that. So this was their biggest challenge and they didn't overcome it.
And Philippe, would you say that PSG are sort of learning? You know, they've got this great attack, but they're more sensible behind Neymar and Mbappe now.
Possibly. I mean, it's very much what Tuchel has tried to do. And at the beginning with meeting some resistance from a number of people who said, you know, what's the point of having, you know, a midfield three with Marquinhos and Gay and Verratti and Paredes and Herrera, of course. But it's something that he's tried to push all through the season to get some kind of consistency. But to be honest, I don't think that the challenge was such that you can have a fair idea of how good exactly this PSG side is, which is crazy to say that. One thing you could say for them is that when the draw was made, we all thought this is a fantastic opportunity for PSG to do something in this competition, which they haven't done before, because it is true they were in the weaker, at least on paper, part of the draw. And they've managed that very well. They haven't necessarily done that in the previous years. I mean, remember what happened against Manchester United, for example. So they have progressed in that way. But I think the real progress will come on the final. We'll be able to judge from that. It's the same thing. Every year we say the same thing, Max. We say, oh, PSG have progressed. And then something terrible happens. It's what we were saying after they beat Barcelona, before the remontada. Oh, they have progressed. They know how to play against the big teams. And then what happened. And then it was back to square one. So we'll know after the final, unless the final is against Lyon, then we still won't know. They will have won and we still won't know if they're good enough.
Maybe. Perhaps if there was a second leg against Leipzig, they'd have lost 4-0. We'll never know the answer to that question, will we? Barry, Neymar is a wonderful player, isn't he? And he is sort of infuriating. But that back-heeled assist for Di Maria it's actually sensational. The pace that the ball is coming to him and to have the sort of speed of thought and mind to see a player that's open and to execute it is ridiculous.
Yeah, I must say I've been a Neymar skeptic for quite a long time, but he's, well, in my mind, he seems to have knuckled down this season and got his act together and seems determined to drag this team as far into this competition as he possibly can and hopefully win it for them. But I probably have been unfair on him. He's suffered a lot from injuries since going to PSG, and his habit of disappearing off to Brazil for a birthday party that lasts a week at the drop of a hat, you know, is probably too much is made of it. But it does suggest he's indisciplined and he's very much the man in charge at PSG, and I suppose up to a point he is. But I have been impressed with him grudgingly impressed with him in this Champions League campaign.
Barry, you know, you don't worry, he hasn't changed too much, because the one player who was leading the dancing and the singing after the game on the way to the hotel and in the hotel was Neymar. So he has changed and he hasn't changed.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely.
After a successful pod, it's Barry who leads the dancing back to the team coach.
In a Flatley-esque Riverdance style.
Juan Bernat scored the third. Interesting, Archie, if he comes up against Bayern in the final, if Bayern get past Lyon.
Yes, because once upon a famous press conference, last season it was, although last season feels about 4 years ago now, Uli Hoeneß lambasted Juan Bernat, who had just left the club for PSG, just several times shouting, "Juan Bernat! Juan Bernat!" And it's become a very memeable phrase in Germany because of a mistake that Bernat made, which nearly cost them a game against Sevilla in their previous Champions League run. Now, Hoeneß did apologise after that, and Bernat was like, "Oh, I'm not that bothered." But it was still a very unnecessary slight. So it would be very 2020 should Juan Bernat score the winner against Bayern in a Champions League final. I'm not sure if Uli Hoeneß will be in the stadium because he's stepped back from his role at Bayern now, but I would just love to see, like, we go live to Uli Hoeneß if Juan Bernat should do something.
Just one more on Neymar. Rob says, is there a chance he's purposefully missing all these easy chances in order to try and lower his transfer fee so a move back to Barcelona is more possible? It's probably the most genius thing he did on the pitch was try and recreate that Joe Bryan free kick, Archie, wasn't it? In homage to the Fulham left back.
Listen, only special players can do that. End of story.
Moving on to more important topics, Julian Nagelsmann's suit. Alex says, I genuinely made a Twitter account to ask a question about Nagelsmann's suit on the pod. Mike referred to it as a must-win suit. Rasmus said, a Danish commentator said it was a suit made out of the hotel carpet. It was bold, Barry, wasn't it?
It was an audacious fashion statement. I'm not really one in a position to criticise anyone's sartorial elegance. I'm sitting in here with a t-shirt that says Cairns, Australia, and a pair of camouflage cargo shorts, which you obviously can't see, that are about 15 years old. So it's not the kind of suit I would wear, but I'm not particularly daring in my fashion statements. I was more taken by the loafers with no socks sort of way he finished it off.
I just thought the trousers were so tight. I just thought, you know, you need to be relaxed and comfortable. Like, by all means, wear what you like. But, like, his buttocks were going to burst out of there at any time, I thought. John Bennett.
They look like two eggs in a hanky.
John Bennett, a BBC reporter, says you could do a whole podcast series on some of his other fashion choices in the technical area of the last two seasons. He's the Jeff Banks of football coaches. Is that fair, Archie?
Who's Jeff Banks?
Jeff Banks hosted The Clothes Show back in the late 80s, early 90s. Thanks for reminding us of how old we all are, Archie.
You're welcome.
Well, tell me about what Nagelsmann wears on a weekly basis.
He's not been that smart, I would say, this season. There's most memorably for me was a bright red tracksuit. So he's got range in his wardrobe. My friend was I need to confirm this, but I believe he has a stylist.
Personal stylist.
Yeah. I don't know where my mate has got this from. But what I can confirm is that Nagelsmann has admitted to having plucked eyebrows and some makeup on before. He's very much your modern... Well, yeah, he's very much your modern man in that sense. He cares about how he looks and how he takes care of himself. So, yeah.
Well, Steve Evans wears mascara and plucks his eyebrows. So, I mean...
Does he?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, like, you know, I'm all for, you know, lots of different people doing different things on the sidelines. Steve Evans was not in the list. In fact, Steve Evans was one of the names that sprang to mind when I was going to say, can you imagine X doing this? I'd have put Evans in with Peter Reid, Roy Keane and Sam Allardyce on the That's Not For Me, Clive. Oh, there you go.
There you go.
Can we talk about Thomas Tuchel as well? I mean, how good a job has he done, Philippe, at PSG, would you say?
He's done what was expected to of him anyway, and what would be expected of any PSG manager. He had a difficult 2018-19 season. You remember when, you know, he actually failed because it is a failure in the domestic leagues, which Paris, you know, Paris has done, what is it, four trebles in the space of just a few years, when it had never been done beforehand. But he's now on the verge of doing something that nobody else has done in terms of winning at this kind of level. He's already reached the final, which PSG had never reached. Some people are comparing in France. I mean, you should see, maybe we should talk about the reaction in France, which is very interesting, actually, the way that it is being celebrated, this qualification. If he wins it, yes, he will definitely have done it. But the extraordinary thing is that, Max, up until this stage of the Champions League, he was really on the receiving end of very serious criticism. And some people said, even within the club, of criticism from people who wanted to basically make him more fragile, including his own sports director. So he was very much in a delicate situation. Now, obviously, he's in the final. And if he wins it, that's it. He's the boss. But that shows you how it works at PSG and why, for example, it's completely wrong to do the parallel between, for example, what happened in Manchester City, if you talk about another club which has had massive investment from the Middle East, and PSG, because the Manchester City project is based around Pep Guardiola and the Barca connection and the people like that. The PSG connection is not based around Thomas Tuchel as the great strategist, not at all. He's an executor, so to speak, but he's executing it better than any of his predecessors.
Thomas Tuchel is the fifth German coach after Ottmar Hitzfeld, Klaus Toppmöller, Jupp Heynckes and Jurgen Klopp to reach a Champions League final. I don't think there's the same euphoria about him reaching a Champions League final as there is for Jurgen Klopp. Jurgen Klopp is the poster boy of everything here. I can't walk around even Cologne where he has no prior involvement without seeing his face smiling back at me with a Weiss beer in hand. Thomas Tuchel is a much more complicated character. If you go back to the places where he's been in his career, if you went back to Dortmund, they would tell you how much they despise him. If you go back to Mainz, it's more of a balanced view that he didn't have the same warmth as Jurgen Klopp, but he was an excellent coach. And you go back to Augsburg's second team and they remember him very fondly. So with a lot of these top coaches, I think you can put them in a box. With Nagelsmann, he's seen as the young one. With Mourinho, he's seen as the cynical one. You have Klopp, who's kind of seen as this guy. He's your every guy. Tuchel is much more difficult to pin down in that way. He's got many sides to him. And I think that what he's done at Paris to have to be able to manage this level of star is something that he didn't have to do at Dortmund, but he didn't do very well. He wasn't able to keep the squad on side, far from it. So I think he's grown a lot in Paris.
You can't put him in a box, but you can put him on a box, can't you, Archie, with his big with his big ankle boot. Barry, can you do me a favour? When I see Tuchel, I see Niles Crane, but I also see Barney Ramey, and I also see Mr. Burns. And then Alan Supermarché says, I see a young skeleton from Super Ted with the hair of Niles Crane. I just need some confirmation of who I'm looking at when I look at Thomas Tuchel.
Well, I definitely got a touch of the Ronnies, all right. But yeah, Niles Crane is a great shout. I think Barney in his match report likened him to some sort of foppish Cambridge Don rifling around in his bookcase. So I suppose it would have been a bit self-indulgent if Barney had said, oh, well, he looks like me.
Right, Bayern Munich, Leon, 8 o'clock tonight then. We'll look back on that on tomorrow's pod with Flo Lloyd-Hughes and John Bruin. Does anyone have any searing predictions for this one?
I have a prediction, but it won't be searing at all. It will be very banal.
Okay, do it.
Well, Bayern will go through 4-1.
Okay, Archie? Any advances on 4-1? Do I hear 5-1?
It's difficult because I don't think
Come on.
I don't think that Leon are going to be as shy about pumping the ball forward as Barcelona were. And they do have the pace to hurt Bayern in behind. The problem is Bayern have Alphonso Davies running with you from one direction and they have Manuel Neuer running at you from the other. And I think that the margin of error that you have...
Manuel Neuer? Is he playing right wing back? Sorry, I misunderstood.
No, well, he's coming from the back, so...
Oh, right, sorry.
He's coming from that way, and you've got right. Davies coming from the other way, because right, Davies okay. just covers the pitch and as he wants.
Carry on.
So the margin that you have to fit through is... About, I've realised as soon as I say what this margin is,
you've caught a small fish. You've caught a small fish there.
37 centimetres, I think, is what Archie's trying to show us.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, it's good that this is a visual medium, huh? Yeah. So exceedingly tight, and the few Bayern goals that they have conceded recently have had to go through VAR tells you about how fine those margins are. You need to get right to score against them. So 4-1, I'm with Philippe.
Barry, do you want to predict it?
I think Bayern will win. If they play badly, Leon play out of the skins, they could get in behind, score on the break. But Bayern are going to have most of the possession. It's difficult not to see them scoring at least two goals, if not more. So Bayern win. Although, I kind of want Bayern to win because I think they will beat PSG, but if Leon were to win and then beat PSG, that would be the funniest thing I will have ever seen in my life on a football field.
Hang on. Philippe, is there anything untoward about Leon that we should know now?
Not really. I mean, the chairman, Jean-Michel Aulas, is somebody who divides opinion in France a lot because his pronouncements are sometimes quite... They cut to the quick, shall we say, and he's not somebody who necessarily is the most humble of people. On the other hand, the club is created as unearth more players of great talent than any other in France. He's the man who actually also made Lyon into the most powerful women's club in Europe. He basically invented women's football in France. I there are loads of things that I don't agree with Jean-Michel Aulas, but I have a tremendous amount of admiration for him and for his team. And so in terms of the way that the club is run, he's a model. And it won't please many people in France that I say that, but he's a model.
Right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Celtic winning in the Champions League on a semi-final night. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So, Celtic won in the Champions League last night, Barry. Andrew says, am I right that Celtic play PSG in the Champions League final now? I'm confused.
Yeah, it's like there's been a rip in the space-time continuum that this season's Champions League qualifying rounds have got underway before last season's Champions League is finished. Celtic, because they're starting almost 2 months late, they're not two-legged affairs. The qualifiers are being played one leg behind closed doors. And Celtic swatted KR Reykjavik from Iceland aside 6-0 with Mo El-Yunusi getting two. He's on loan from Southampton. And they'll host either Ferencváros from Hungary or Djurgårdens from Sweden in the next qualifying round, which will take place next week. They're playing tonight. And elsewhere, Linfield from Northern Ireland, they were unlucky to go out. They're managed by David Healy. They had a red card late in the game, and then they lost 1-0 to Legia Warsaw, who Artur Boric is back playing for, former Celtic legend. He's finished with Bournemouth, and he's gone back to Legia Warsaw, which is sort of where he made his name 20 years ago.
On the last pod, a quote from Barry Glendening. Shakhtar, hugely impressive against Basel. They could beat Inter. They've crept under the radar. Inter Milan 5, Shakhtar Donetsk 0. Didn't quite pick it, Barry, but it was close.
My heart was sinking further towards my boots every time Inter scored in that game because I knew I'd get hammered for it. I was surprised that Shakhtar didn't put up a better show. They created several chances when they were only 1-0 down, but Inter's second kind of finished them off, and it was a procession after that, just one-way traffic. So Inter, I don't see enough of Inter to know how good they are, but it was an impressive performance against a team I thought were decent, but maybe I overestimated how good they were or how bad Basel were in the previous game between those two sides.
I was going to say, I was there the other night, and Barry, I don't think your prediction was was as wayward as the final scoreline would suggest, because Shakhtar were well in that game until the second goal, and their defender Kokolava said after it that after that their heads just went. But I think what the result shows us about Inter is just how ruthless and relentless they are, and every bit an Antonio Conte side that they are. Just seeing him on the touchline is a performance in itself. The energy that he has to push his players forward, I'm pretty sure he runs as much as they do on the pitch, just in that 10 yards that he has in the technical box. Because even in the 80th minute, he is still pushing each and every player forward. And like, I've seen them live twice now in the past few weeks, and they are very good. To the point that I'm wondering, how did they get knocked out of a group with Borussia Dortmund and Barcelona this season? I can't quite wrap my head around that. But particularly going forward, Lautaro Martinez and Romelu Lukaku. Lukaku onto 33 goals in all competitions this season. I think the previous club record for Inter is 34, scored by Ronaldo, the Brazilian one, back in 1998. And that was the last time that Inter lifted the UEFA Cup / Europa League.
Up to Joe, Inter Milan's 5-0 win over Shakhtar is the biggest margin of victory in a single Europa League UEFA Cup semi-final game. Lars Sivertsen tweeting, yet another unfortunate evening for the Lukaku is rubbish crowd, who are having a fairly dismal season overall. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's just proof that he wasn't brilliant at United. You know, I don't know if it was a total failure for United to sell him, but you sort of think he'd be quite good for them now. But you cannot quite work at one football club and work at another one, Philippe.
Yes, and when you say it didn't quite work out Manchester United, I think you could say the same thing of a number of players who were at Manchester United for whom it didn't quite work out as well. I mean, I can't remember Anthony Martial, who's had a very decent season, being that great at the time either, even though the relationship between Martial and Lukaku was one actually of the few things which was working at Manchester United for a while. I mean, he's a typical example of a player who is victim of complete stereotyping. I've always been a fan, always will be a fan of Romelu Lukaku. I mean, you're talking 33 in 55, Archie. It's also 6-5 in the Europa League. He scored in every single game, and there's so much more to his game than what the traditional qualities people equate to, you know, with him, given the way he looks and the way, you know, how big a guy he is. But his game intelligence is superb, and also he's a player who will carry on improving. He's still very young. That's the crazy thing. He's 27 years of age. So only. And he's been absolutely fantastic. And there's one thing for Inter which puzzles me a little bit, is that in a way they've been bucking the trend, because and the trend was that the clubs coming from the leagues which finished very, very late had real problems adapting to the rhythm of the European competitions. And we saw that for Juve, for example. We saw that for other clubs too. They don't seem to be affected as the others have been by the lack of physical resources. And they showed that they were completely on top physically and technically in this competition. And they've been quite exceptional on this level as well as on others.
Inter Sevilla on Friday. We'll look back at that. We're doing a special Sunday night podcast after the Champions League final. Me, Barry, Wilson and Johnny Liu. So we'll look back at that game as well. Great headline from the Daily Mail. Ronald Koeman is already facing the sack at Barcelona next year, regardless of how well he does. It hasn't all been signed, sealed and delivered yet, but he will be the new manager of Barcelona, according to the current club president, Josep Maria Bartomeu. He's currently in charge of the Netherlands, set to join Barca next week. Great that he's already facing the boot, Baz, isn't it?
Well, I see why you could derive amusement from that, but the headline isn't as misleading or ridiculous as you're making it out to be, because it seems to be a given that he will sign a 2-year deal and leave after 1 year, because there will be presidential elections at Barcelona in March. Bartomeu will get the boot, and the fellow who's coming in to replace him, Victor Font, I think his name is, he's a big Xavi Hernandez fan, and he will bring, unless Koeman is doing extraordinarily well and made himself unsackable, which seems unlikely with the rabble he's about to inherit, he will have to make way for Xavi Hernandez.
So do you think Koeman is doing the right thing then, saying, look, I'll go for a year, get a big payoff and get another job? Or do you think, given how the Barcelona job is seemingly his dream, that he should hold on and try and do something with the Netherlands and then go to Barcelona another time? Or can you go back to Barcelona?
Well, it's a free hit for him, I suppose, because he will get another job regardless of how he fares at Barcelona. Perhaps he's so confident in his own abilities, and having met him and sat on a couple of his pressers when he was at Southampton, he does seem to have a huge amount of self-regard. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but maybe he thinks he will do such a good job that he will make himself unsackable. And if he doesn't, it's not much of a problem. I don't think if the Barcelona job is your dream job, you can't turn it down. You can't be picky about when you take it.
I would say when you say a free hit, I mean, I'm looking at the list of Barcelona managers since Pep Guardiola left, or I should say since Tito Villanova, tragically was, couldn't carry on doing his work there. And, I read Gerardo Martino, Luis Enrique, Ernesto Valverde, and Quique Setién. It's not exactly a job from which you rebound very easily, is it, the last few years? And it is a big gamble, because I think many people felt that Koeman, in a way, had found the ideal job for him at the head of the Dutch team. And his impact had been excellent. But he's never hidden the fact that he wanted to go back to his club and to be the manager there. I still think it's a very risky move. But more Celtic, actually, news about, because it's all about Celtic. Henrik Larsson is apparently going to join him there. And talking about Celtic as well, we forgot to say that Celtic were also in the semi-final of the Champions League, thanks to Dembele, of course. You didn't mention that, Max.
Ah, yeah, good point. Not only were they playing in the semi-final last night, they're playing in the semi-final tonight as well.
As well, two extraordinary seasons times. At once, extraordinary.
They've been both semi-finals with no chance of making the final. Barcelona also parted company with sporting director Eric Abidal on Tuesday. Yeah, there's a lot to fix, isn't there?
Wasn't that after they made him sack Quique Setién the day before?
That was his last act. But the Barcelona president said he asked to leave. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what was
in the same said. Way that somebody asks to leave a ship when they're on the edge of a plank, I think.
You should compare the statement which was published by Barcelona after the departure of Eric Abidal with the departure with the statements they put up with departures of previous ones. Actually, it was a love letter to Eric Abidal. It was in stark contrast with the, shall we say, quite dry tone of the other statements.
But it is like a sort of domino rally where they're all stood in a line and you point to one and you say, thank you for your service. And then you turn around and someone else says it to you, thank you for your service. And you just keep going up the line until there's nobody there.
The guy who sacked Eric Abidal is sweating today.
Right, that'll do for part two. Round up any other business in part three, starting with Joe Hart at Spurs. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Joe Hart has joined Spurs on a free transfer, two-year deal. I feel like I've got a lot of quality and a lot in the bank, said Hart. Hecky says, will Joe Hart be fourth choice at Spurs behind Lloris, Gazzaniga and young Alfie Whitman? Quite often a figure of fun, Barry. We've talked about it here a couple of times, and that he is still, for a goalkeeper, relatively young. And you hope that he can get back to the confidence that he had at some point before.
Yeah, he has become a figure of ridicule. He seems like a nice enough guy. I've never met him. I don't know him. But I would imagine he will be second choice, because the reason Spurs have bought him is because they need more homegrown players in their squad. So in that regard, he could be just one injury to Hugo Lloris away from getting in the Spurs first team. I think he's in the last chance saloon as far as being a Premier League footballer is concerned. But if he were to get in and string a series of good games together, I'm not sure has the confidence. Well, he seems to have a lot of confidence, but I think some of it might be misplaced. I'm not sure if he's good enough to string a series of good games together without making serious ricks. But I don't see it as a bad move. He may not get any game time, but Lloris is quite injury prone, so he could very well get a chance to establish himself in the Tottenham first team, and then it's up to him to take it.
How good is Lloris these days, Philippe?
Oh, terrific. he has his detractors, because when he makes a mistake, these mistakes tend to be quite spectacular and often cost quite a bit. But in fact, no, his level has been, I think, overall absolutely excellent, be it with Spurs or with the French national team. He's not a young man any longer. I mean, Hugo Lloris, but it doesn't show. He looks after himself extremely well. He's very fit. He certainly as driven and motivated as he always was. And I think, yes, he's somebody who's been a victim of a couple of mistakes, you know, be it with France or with Spurs. But we certainly, for me, still one of the best keepers in the Premier League. And when it comes to his spot as number one in the French team, sometimes people talk about others, but no, he remains the number one.
I think it's when he makes a mistake, he looks so terribly sad.
Yeah, he does.
I think that makes a difference.
I couldn't resist a wry grin there where Philippe said, talking about how well he looks after himself, and thinking back to that incident.
Happened
where
once!
Vomited in the footwell of his Lamborghini.
Well, he also said he was really driven, didn't he? Which is
yeah, it was very much out of character. It was very much out of character.
We all have bad days, Philippe.
Exactly.
David Silva made a late change. He was on the way to Lazio, and then decided to go to Real Sociedad, despite agreeing with the club. Lazio's sporting director Iglitare said in a statement, "I learnt about David Silva's transfer to Real Sociedad. I have great respect for the player, but not for the man."
He's done a Marcelo Bielsa there. Bielsa famously went to Lazio for 2 days and then didn't. I don't think Bielsa ever turned up there, but he signed the deal and said he was coming and then he didn't. So
Lazio make a terrible first impression. Do you think they've got this old cook that makes really terrible food? They're like, oh no, someone's got to tell him because we'll lose another one now. Anyway,
it was extraordinary, Max. I mean, this statement from the sporting director was on the Lazio official website. I've never seen that in my life before. Sometimes you have somebody being a bit lippy on the mic and saying something that maybe they shouldn't have been saying. In this case, it was a statement, was the only sentence on the whole page, was that, which is quite extraordinary.
This from Baz says, "With David Silva's contribution to Manchester City being recognised this week with a statue outside the Etihad, how would Barry like his service to Football Weekly to be commemorated upon his retirement?"
You could retire my little rectangular box and the Zoom chat, I suppose.
Oh, dear.
Or retire Barry's chair. No one's allowed to sit in it ever again.
Maybe part three could be known as the Barry Glendenning part, or we could retire Fitbar Corner.
A golden pack of fags?
That's it, a golden packet of cigarettes. It's a very good idea. Now, it's FIFA time, Philippe. You've got 1 minute to tell us about the High Court in Trinidad.
Yeah, it might sound like it's something which doesn't really matter, but the same way that it didn't really matter, it seemed at the time when Jean-Marc Bosman won his case at the European High Court of Justice, and we all know what happened after that. What happened in Trinidad is the High Court of the country had been asked to issue a verdict on a quarrel between the Trinidad and Tobago Football Association and FIFA. That's already very unusual, that FIFA being taken to court like this in the High Court like that. What is even more unusual is that the High Court found in favour of the Trinidad and Tobago Football Association, which had been basically all but replaced by FIFA in March of this year. Now, this is very unusual because what this judgment does, and there'll be another one, a so-called substantive judgment to come, is that for the first time, a High Court of Justice has decided that the supreme authority, when it came to a quarrel between a football association and FIFA, was not FIFA, was not the Court of Arbitration for Sport, but was that country's High Court. So suddenly, you think, oh, wait a minute. All these cases which we've seen going to CAS, all these cases where FIFA has decided, we're going to normalize you, we're going to put a new administration in place, if they can be challenged rightfully, that's a complete sea change in the way football governance will work. So which is why, yes, it's not something that is going to make the headlines, but it's something which is of great importance for the development of football governance, not just in Trinidad, but absolutely everywhere.
And Newcastle's held talks with the Singapore-backed company Belagraph Nova Group, BNG, about a possible takeover bid. BNG was co-founded by Singapore-based investors and headquartered in Paris, said negotiations were at an advanced stage. The group was willing to, quote, massively contribute to the club's development. In a statement, the company said, in addition to the engagement to the Newcastle Football Club and community, Belgrave Nova Group enlisted help of England captain Alan Shearer and former player Michael Chopra. Is this a real thing, Philippe?
Yeah, I think that this is to be taken very seriously. I mean, we're not BNG, the group that we're talking about, is a rather important one. I mean, it controls a number of commercial entities in the Far East. They have a revenue of about £12 billion per annum, so which is, you know, quite considerable. It seems as well that this is the kind of bid for which they've provided, by the way, a letter of intent as and also proof of funds, because what you do is that you show they've got the money, it's available there, it's in the bank, you've got to show it. So they've got that, which means I also think that probably the Premier League is going to look at this kind of bid as a kind of relief compared to what happened beforehand. And I can't see anything really preventing them from doing so if Mike Ashley indeed is interested in that. The other thing is that there are other possibilities. There is rumors of another possible bid coming from another Gulf source, which might be a little bit more amenable, shall we say, to the Premier League than the previous one. So it looks as if, you know, we finally come to a resolution of that situation, thankfully for Newcastle United supporters.
The Carabao Cup draw first round was yesterday. Barry, where's the box?
It's in my locker in Guardian Towers, where I think I've been twice in the last 5 months.
Have you fed and watered the box? Is there a bit of air?
I have not fed and watered the box. Dear. It's been criminally neglected.
Oh, wow. Anyway, the draw managed to take place without the box in full view. Derby, Barrow, Sunderland, Hull, Newport, Swansea and all Welsh clash there. Luton, Norwich and the mighty U's go to Birmingham so we can concentrate on the league. Nice tweet about pre-season friendlies from Carshalton AFC. The Beckenham Town number 7 has had a minute to forget as he throws punches at two Carshalton players before seeing a red and then punching a Carshalton steward on his way to the changing room. Ruined the good spirit and atmosphere in Colston Avenue there. A couple of questions for you, Archie, to finish the pod. Ali says, is there an update from Archie about his neighbour calling the police after the playoff final? Has he come clean?
So no. The neighbour didn't call the police. The neighbour nearly called the police.
Ah, I see.
I met another neighbour on the stairs who's from Spain and was like, yeah, I heard you screaming, no worries. To be honest, what was it, cricket? And I was like, oh, okay, so you're just putting me in that box then.
Craig says, how is Archie's dating life coming along now that COVID restrictions have been eased?
I've actually deleted all dating apps off my phone.
Oh, really?
About a month and a half now.
Okay.
Not that you're going to get any info on anything that does happen.
This isn't about you, Archie. This is about the pod and the listeners.
This is about everybody trying to live vicariously through me. and it's not just the first time. I have mates who say this, like, oh, what's going on? Like, hang on, are you just going to... You're just listening to The Guardian pod. It's like, yeah. It's like, oh, for God's sake. So, yeah. That's happening. Anything else?
No, there's no more questions for you, Archie, but thanks for answering them so definitely there. And that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you so much for your time, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Archie.
Thank you.
We're back tomorrow. Me, Baz, Flo, John Bruin, looking back on Bayern Munich versus Lyon.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.